Thank you very much, Nick. It's a great pleasure to be here and really grateful to be a part of the group and to be among so many enormously fine individuals. It's very daunting, of course, to follow in the footsteps of Steve Hyman's excellent keynote address last night and George Ainslie's very thoughtful analysis this morning and Pat Churchland's wonderful commentary. It's especially daunting because I don't know much about addiction. All I can talk about are psychological processes generated by mesolimbic systems. What does what? That's what I can talk about. And worse, I can only talk about it really coming from observations in rats. So what can I tell you, really? But there's one psychological mechanism that I'd like to focus on because I think it might be interesting and maybe illuminating in thinking about what happens at the moment of a temptation. As preferences reverse, as we heard so often they do today, what happens at that temptation of moment? Is it a revision of the judgment as we switch our temporal selves? Is it an act against the judgment, sort of a competition among multiple selves in a single moment, or at least mechanisms, multiple mechanisms within ourselves? What is the mechanism of motivation that becomes compelling? What's recruited specifically at the moment of temptation? It's that moment. And how does the process of addiction conceivably change that mechanism that gets recruited at the moment of temptation? And I want to say, the little caveat is simply to say, this is what I want to present is the psychological mechanism of incentive salience, a form of wanting. But it's not meant to be a monolithic account for addiction. It's not meant to counter in any way other views of addiction or drug use that certainly apply to many people and cases. So if you believe that addicts often take drugs for the pleasure of the drug or that people take drugs for the pleasure of the drug, absolutely. If we think that they're taking it often to get relief from an aversive, nasty state of withdrawal, absolutely. If there are habits or social accounts for why you're taking drugs, certainly, of course. But, you know, sometimes all of those are missing at a moment of temptation. They don't have to be there. And the question I want to raise is, what happens when we give in to temptation, even when there's not incredible pleasure, we're not in a state of withdrawal, there aren't particularly social compelling reasons to take it? That's what I want to focus on, a mechanism that could give an explanation for that. In a way, I'm going to talk about multiple systems of motivation, the notion that at any moment we might have multiple motives operating at different levels. In a way, this is analogous to an idea that we're all familiar with, the notion of multiple learning systems that could coexist in us from moment to moment. The work of Steve Hyman, the work of Matthew Rushmuth, were on multiple forms of learning being mediated by different brain systems at the same moment. That's familiar to us. What if there were multiple forms of motivation that could be called upon at any moment? Of course, there's conscious desire, which is wanting, the word wanting in the ordinary sense, it's what we all mean, and that I can say nothing about. Most of you can say much more about that. Everybody here, and a number of you have and will talk about that, George Ainslie, Steve Pearson, Hannah Pickard later this afternoon, and Richard Holton. Conscious desire, of course, is a cognitive evaluation or tied to a cognitive evaluation of future goodness. In Daniel Kahneman's utility terms, it's tied often to predictions, predicted utility of future goodness, which are often based largely on past memories or experiences of past goodness, the remembered utility. And, of course, cognitive desires mediated by largely cortically weighted neural systems. In those cases, conscious desire cases, the decision utility of a choice typically equals the predicted utility of that choice. If it's best that you expect, you choose what's best to be expected. But what I want to talk about today is something totally different and below the surface. It's not that. It may often go with that simultaneously. Incentive salience is cue-triggered wanting in a quotation mark sense, in a mesolimbic mechanism sense, and a different psychological process sense. When it goes together with conscious cognitive desires, it can give a motivational oomph to what it is that we desire. But there are times, occasions, when I think incentive salience can separate from a cognitive desire, so multiple things pointing in different directions. And in its strongest cases, it can give rise to an incentive salience wanting of what is not cognitively wanted, not cognitively desired. In the strongest cases, the two forms of strongest cases would be unconscious incentive salience wanting, which would be incentive salience in the absence of a cognitive desire, or even possibly, treading on very thin ice here, I want to posit the notion of irrational wanting, which would be incentive salience wanting in opposition to a simultaneous but different cognitive desire. And it's going to be mediated by subcortically weighted circuits. And in these cases, here's maybe a crucial point. In these cases, decision utility could exceed the predicted utility. It's possible to want something beyond the degree to which we predict it's going to be enjoyed, beyond the degree to which we expect it to be pleasant or good. I'll unpack that more, I think. So I'd like to today lay on the table some features of incentive salience. Some of it is intuitive, some features are, but others I think are not so intuitive, and I'd like to kind of show you some evidence of what those features are. Incentive salience, I'll lay on the table these features. I'll briefly make a foray and application of incentive salience to addiction. And then at the end of the talk, the last few minutes, I'd like to try to raise some issues, more general issues, implications that might be relevant to philosophy. So, features. Incentive salience is a cue-triggered want. It's a want that's bound to the occurrence, usually, of stimuli associated with reward. When Steve Hyman told us about Pavlovian conditioning last night, it's Pavlovian conditioning that is the kind of learning that is an input to incentive salience. Just one input, but an important input. The important thing about a Pavlovian cue, when and if it's attributed with incentive salience, is that at that moment of reencounter, at that moment of attribution of incentive salience to the cue, if it is attributed, drawing upon subcortically dopamine-related circuits, it does a couple of psychological things. One is it triggers a sudden, temporary peak of wanting for the reward that goes along with it. So that's the urge for the reward. It's a very special moment of temptation. A couple people already have alluded to the famous Michelle Child social psychology experiment in which children were asked to forego a single marshmallow in order to get two marshmallows later. And they found it much harder to wait if they could see the two marshmallows during the period when they had to wait. There's something about that tempting cue, the sight of the marshmallow, that triggers wanting. It's hard to resist, and that's a moment of special temptation. But here is maybe the most important thing I'd like to say today. Cues may elicit wanting, but they don't always elicit wanting. The motivational value of a cue, it's not something inherent in the associative value of the cue that's stable over time. It's not. The memory of the cue is stable if we're not learning further, but the motivational value can vary from moment to moment. Cues fluctuate in potency, and I think addiction is a marvelous case of this. You know, someone who's trying to give up a drug may successfully resist the cues again and again and again. And then at some moment, a special moment, they can't resist. What's happening differently in that special moment? Is it context? Is it something else? Well, that's what I want to talk about. To kind of lay out the natural psychological features of incentive salience, I'd like to step back from addiction for a moment and turn to the origins of incentive salience in natural appetites, because I think we can expose a mechanism here that wouldn't be so easily exposed in addiction. There's a synergy between a cue and a certain mesolimbic state of this moment that can generate incentive salience if both are present, but if either is missing, they won't. And salt appetite is a great example of a pure process that can expose certain something. Last night, Walter and Steve compared the rewards of cake and sex and drugs, and pointed to a fundamental difference, right, between drugs and cake and sex. Cake and sex we typically have enjoyed. We've liked them in the past. There's been pleasant all the time. Drugs may or may not. Drugs keyed in directly was the point last night. Well, absolutely so. But you know, cake and sex don't have to follow their usual pattern. They usually do. But cake, sex, and drugs are all tapping in, I think, to a mesolimbic mechanism which can reveal, can operate in a direct fashion. And here's why I want to use salt appetite to kind of show. Incentive salience making a cue into a motivational magnet, even though the cue has never been liked and the reward associated with the cue has never, ever been liked. It's going to be a cake-like thing, but behaving not as a cake. So here's the experiment to kind of show this feature. And I apologize in advance for going so far from addiction, but maybe it will become clear why I want to do this feature. I want to show you a case where the mesolimbic system interacts with learning to generate incentive salience to make a cue wanted at this moment, even though this cue has never been paired with dopamine squirts in the past. This cue has never been paired with the conscious experience of pleasure in the past. Instead, it's been pleasure with terrible things, but we're going to still create a want. That's, I think, relevant to addiction. In this case, this experiment, it'll have to be a rat experiment, I apologize for that too. There's going to be two different cues and two different rewards to sort of see how it's working. One will be a cake, a unconditioned stimulus of sucrose, a solution of sucrose squirted into a rat's mouth. That's cake, essentially. And there's a cue, there's a cue that predicts that. It's a lever that just pops out of the wall. This lever pops out of the wall, and it predicts 10 seconds later the squirt of sugar water into the mouth. And this happens in a Pavlovian fashion. Pop, squirt. Pop, squirt. Okay, so there's a cue, there's an association formed. But a different CS lever pops out of the other wall. And this lever predicts a squirt of intensely salty water into the mouth. It's so salty, it's triple the concentration of seawater. Have you ever had a mouthful of seawater? Well, triple that. That's how nasty that is. And the rat gapes and shakes and doesn't like it. So you're going to see the cake sugar cue becomes a motivational magnet. Of course, the salt cue doesn't. But then suddenly one day, after this has been learnt for several days, one surprising day, the rat is put into a state of sodium appetite by giving it drugs that deplete the body's sodium. So it's in a state of salt appetite. You and I have never been in that. The rat has never been in that. But on this day, suddenly it will be. And on this day, if it had salt, salt would be delicious, but it's not going to get any salt at the moment of the test. It has never tasted salt as delicious. Salt has always been nasty. The question is, what's going to happen when the cue for salt pops out of the wall? Will it still avoid it? It's not going to avoid it. It'll become a motivational magnet. And here, let me show you this. So this is a rat who's getting sugar cues. And here's the lever. And you can see it nibbling at the cue. This will squirt entirely painlessly. Now it's getting a squirt of sugar water into its mouth, a squirt that followed the sugar cue that it was nibbling. Now here's the salt cue that's going to pop out here, the lever. It's popping out, and the rat is staying away from that salt lever. This is a normal day, training, right? So the sugar is a motivational magnet, the sugar cue, and the salt cue is not. But now, today, they're sodium depleted. The rat is right over there at that salt cue, and here it goes, the lever comes out, and there it is, nibbling away at this salty cue. It's a piece of metal. It's always been paired with nasty things, but on this day, you can see it's a motivational magnet. The motivational value, and there's a comparison, the normal day versus the sodium-depleted day, same lever, same rat, suddenly it's a motivational magnet. This doesn't make sense by some frameworks, right? But it makes perfect sense by a mesolimbic incentive salience framework. And I've never, I think, been clear enough about this, so I want to do that today. Why is that happening? Well, this is kind of a model of incentive salience. It's distinguishing between wanting and liking. I'll say a bit about that. The different colors, that's what really stands out. But what's relevant right now is that the Pavlovian associations of a cue paired with its UCS that feed into both wanting and liking, they are one source of input to the mechanism, but the other source is physiological signals. In this case, it's a drive signal of salt appetite, all right? But it could also be mesolimbic activations by drugs, we'll see in a moment, which multiply that. In drawing on computational kinds of frameworks, the beautiful Wolfram Schultz work that's given rise to the prediction error models of dopamine learning, prediction error equations, this model is taking the prediction error equation as its input. This is RT. It's really the learnt value of the Q according to a prediction error model. But the incentive salience in this model, this is a computational model by Jun Zhang, a mathematical psychology colleague. The incentive salience V is being this incentive salience V is a product of the prediction error value multiplied by the current state of the moment, in this case the salt appetite. It transforms the motivational value of the Q. It transforms the motivational value of the Q so that the Q becomes attractive, it grabs attention, and it becomes, as you saw, nibblable, sniffable, approachable in so many ways. A feature of incentive salience that I think I've never been clear about, though it's always been a part of the notion, is that it really transforms the perception of whatever it is that's getting incentive salience. When that lever pops out to the rat, if it gets incentive salience, it looks more attractive. It's riveting in some way. You know, I think representations in the brain are reflecting motivation to a surprising degree, and the reach of motivation into representations in the brain goes almost all the way down, surprisingly. Just to show how far things might go down, this is a slide from Schuler and Baer of Brown University, a slide from Science, which showed that visual cortex neurons, which are responding to visual events, they're not just responding to visual events, they're also responding to the motivational significance of the visual cue event, like a lever. In this case, the rats were looking at little lights, which had been paired with sugar water at a certain time. And at the moment the sugar water should come, whether it comes or not, these neurons in the visual cortex start to fire differently, even though the lights haven't changed. There's something about the visual representation. This really is a transformation in the perception of the stimulus. Now, does it still look like a light? Of course it still looks like a light. It's physically stable in so many ways. But there's something about this representation which is changing. And I would suggest it's a motivational value that's embedded in this representation. Of course, when we move to more limbic systems of the brain, Q-triggered representations are even stronger. In a sense, the limbic system is the site of the transforms, and we can see them very, very powerfully. So, as Nora Volkow has shown, the site of cocaine cues activates limbic systems in people. And as Steve Hyman described to us last night, Wolfram Schultz originally showed that the cue for reward, the cue for fruit juice, activates the mesolimbic dopamine neurons as well as fruit juice ever did, even better than fruit juice will today. Now, of course, this is interpreted by Wolfram Schultz and many others as a pure prediction signal, predicted utility. It could be that. It could be the motivational value of this prediction. What do you suppose the limbic neurons would be doing in the rat you just saw, whose salt lever popped out on it on that day? The salt lever, each time during training, would never have elicited dopamine or limbic firing because it's paired with nasty salt. But what do you suppose limbic neurons do on the salt, on the sodium depletion day? Well, I don't know about dopamine neurons because I've never been involved in recording them, and I don't think anybody has done this experiment with dopamine neurons. But the output target of dopamine neurons, through the accumbens to the ventral pallidum, neurons there dramatically, suddenly start to fire to the Pavlovian cue for salt on the sodium depletion day, though they've never fired to it up until that moment. It's a limbic transformation. All of these kinds of cue-triggered limbic activations can happen kind of below the surface of cognitive awareness in people. It's not coincident with a cognitive recognition of the stimulus. It doesn't require a full-blown cognitive representation of what's desired. So this is a beautiful little study by Anna Rose Childress and colleagues who showed that very brief 1/30th second flashes of cocaine or sex cues, 1/30th of a second, to cocaine addicts would activate their limbic system, especially nucleus accumbens and ventral pallidum. It was too brief to know what these slides were, but it was sufficient to activate these systems. This is going to be kind of relevant to the notion that mesolimbic activation of incentive salience is conceivably independent, maybe sometimes like here, operating in the absence of a full-blown, certainly conscious recognition of the cause, maybe a conscious recognition of the goal. So those are some features. Maybe it's only fair at this point to actually really turn to addiction and to say, well, what would it mean? What does it mean applied to addiction? The incentive salience sensitization hypothesis posed by my colleague originally, Terry Robinson, originally 20 years ago, draws upon these notions of incentive salience, of cues triggering the wants, incentive salience wanting, independent of liking, I'll say a moment. And it's the notion that the wanting could grow if something could activate the mesolimbic systems. If in an addict you could get a progressive hyper-reactivity, a progressive increase in reactivity, doesn't have to be active all the time, but just reactivity to the cues at certain moments, if that could happen, you could get elevation in these cue-triggered wants, increasing the motivational magnet properties of these cues, even in the absence of liking, even in the absence of memories of liking, as I've just showed you, and maybe even in the absence of liking at this moment, if the reward is taken at this moment. That I'll just say a word very briefly about. This talk is not really a liking talk, so it's not so much a liking versus wanting talk, it's really a wanting talk. But I here want to take 1 minute to talk about liking mechanisms and the difference between liking mechanisms versus incentive salience wanting mechanisms. Pleasures exist, and our brains activate to them, as many people have shown. And a beautiful set of studies has been done here at Oxford by Morten Kringelbach and a number of his colleagues working with him over the years, where there's a great deal of evidence that in the orbital frontal cortex, for example, there's a coding specifically of pleasure, even when pleasures change, but the sensation doesn't. So say when you're hungry or full, beautiful work done here, same taste. Many sites in the brain light up to pleasures, perhaps the orbital frontal cortex best, but many sites light up. However, not all of them are necessarily causing the liking for the pleasure. There are always more codes than causes in the brain for any psychological event, I think. So which are doing the causes? It's hard to know if we're just watching the brain. We kind of have to manipulate the brain and see which changes the actual hedonic liking for a pleasure. Well, there are causes, I think, and there are just a couple I'll mention here in 30 seconds. But how would one know? It's harder to manipulate the brain in people. Of course, it is possible, and there are studies here at Oxford on deep brain stimulation. They'll give rise to great information. In animals, it's feasible to manipulate. But as Steve Hyman pointed out last night, you can't interview the animals and ask them about their pleasure. So how would one ever get a sense of liking in a causal studies of animals? Well, maybe as we could tell from a human infant if it likes something. I want to go back 1 second, sorry. We're going to see a human infant from Jacob Steiner's lab in Israel who's getting sugar water on its mouth, a droplet of sugar water. And then we'll see a rat who's getting sugar water infused into its mouth. And then we'll see the opposite reaction to bitter in both babies. Here's a baby, newborn, first day of life, sugar water, showing tongue protrusions. Here's a rat looking from underneath, showing tongue protrusions. It's too fast, so let's slow it down. Tongue protrusions, sort of licking of its lips and then to the side, licking of the lips. There we go. Here's the bitter quinine. Very different gapes, see? A lot of middle face, wrinkling of the brow and squinting of the eyes. Rats can't do middle face movements. They don't have the musculature, but they can do gapes and head shaking and forelimb flails, a few others. So here's the rat getting bitter quinine. Maybe there's a sense of difference in the hedonic impact. Brain manipulations will increase the liking reactions, at least in the rat. Who knows for the baby? We can manipulate the rat. And there's a couple of hedonic hotspots, one in the nucleus accumbens, where if it's activated, just a tiny spot of a cubic millimeter in the rat is able to do this, as far as we can tell, where if it's activated by opioid signals or endocannabinoid signals, natural marijuana, or benzodiazepine signals in other spots of the brain, in the nucleus accumbens, a cubic millimeter hotspot, also in the ventral pallidum output of the accumbens, a cubic millimeter hedonic causing hotspot. Even in the brain stem, there is a spot. They're neurochemically restricted, just a few signals so far that's able to do this. They're anatomically restricted, these liking substrates, a cubic millimeter more or less in the rats. In a person, if it were proportional, a cubic centimeter perhaps. Just in certain structures, And the circuit is integrated. If we turn on one of these hotspots with a micro injection that's painless to turn it on, it will activate the other hotspot. Neurons will express FOS gene. If we turn on one but turn off the other, the pleasure enhancement goes away. It needs to recruit the whole circuit. It needs unanimity among this hedonic hotspot activation to increase the liking reactions. And it's hierarchical. There's sort of a forebrain and brainstem organization. 10 seconds to just give one example, then I leave liking. So this is the nucleus accumbens hotspot blown up to sort of show you what it is. Micro injections of opioid stimulating drugs spread a little bit. You can see the neurons activated with FOS. That gives the size of these symbols here. Wherever it's green, it's turning on appetite, wanting for food. So wherever it's green, the rat eats more, up to 8 times more food when opioid is micro-injected into these green spots. All the nucleus accumbens supports this wanting for food. The green extends under the orange. Wherever it's orange, it's both turning on the increase in eating and turning on an increase in these liking reactions to sugar. Food isn't only wanted, but it's also liked in this hedonic hotspot here. This is the hedonic hotspot. This is how it's defined. And you can see it's only a tenth of the nucleus accumbens. It's only a third of the medial shell that we're looking at here. So that's an example. But wanting is far more robust than that spindly little liking substrate, far more robust. It's always activated by liking. Wanting is always activated by liking. Everything we do in the brain that turns on liking also enhances the wanting. But there's many things that will turn on wanting that don't turn on liking. So that's why I say it's more widespread and more robust. And maybe the most dramatic ways we've kind of isolated wanting by itself are things that tap into the pathways that Pat talked about today and Steve Hyman last night that activate the mesolimbic dopamine glutamate system that sort of specifically activate those kinds of things. And I just want to give two examples from rats and a couple examples from people. Wanting without liking. Because wanting without liking could be an important thing in addiction. So the first of the two examples from rats. Last night, the marvelous pleasure electrodes discovered by James Olds and Peter Milner were described, and we were talking a little bit, several of us this morning, about the pleasure electrodes done in both animals and people. Those electrodes stimulate the lateral hypothalamus. They stimulate the mesolimbic pathway through a couple of steps, and they do turn on dopamine release. Those rewarding electrodes, they were also famous because they were motivating electrodes. So studies, for example, with Elliott Valenstein or studies by Neil Miller long ago showed that the same electrodes that rats would work for also would turn on some motivation. If you just gave the electrodes stimulation freely, it would turn on motivation. Very typically, the motivation to eat. So rats under the stimulation would throw themselves on food. Others would drink. Others would engage in sex. Each with maternal behavior, other kinds of natural behaviors, motivating. And it was thought, at least one hypothesis was thought, that the reason it was motivating was because it was enhancing pleasures. The electrode could be pleasant, and it could make everything more pleasant. The food more pleasant, the water more pleasant, the sex more pleasant, more like cake. Enhancing the liking for everything, and indeed it could have done. Another example we'll look at in a moment is a little bit more modern, turning on dopamine systems kind of specifically through a genetic mutation. a collaboration with Xiaoji Zhang, a molecular biologist at the University of Chicago, who has hyperdopamine mutant mice. Last night, mutant mice lacking dopamine were mentioned, but suppose you have extra dopamine in the synapse. In this case, because it's a knockdown of the dopamine transporter molecular vacuum cleaner that normally sucks dopamine back out of the synapse, back into the neuron. If you knock that down, you break the vacuum cleaner and you have extra dopamine spilling into the synapse. Both of these things are very, very motivating. So here's an example of them being motivating. Here's the electrodes in the hypothalamus. It's turning on eating behavior. When the electrode is on, the rats eat much more than when the electrode is off, the same rats. All of these are painless. Here's the hyperdopamine mutant mice wanting sugary rewards more than normal control mice. This was in a runway task, and you can see they're running more directly for their sugary reward. They ignore distractions, they get to the reward more rapidly. It's not that they're faster runners, but they just are more focused on the goal. And Xiaoji Zhang has shown that in many ways they want sugary rewards more than other mice. They could want the rewards more, of course, because they like the rewards more. This dopamine could make it more pleasant. So do they? Well, applying those liking facial reactions that showed the hedonic hotspot to these dopamine, here's the answer for both of them. The answer is no for both cases. The electrode stimulation on the left, the rats, this is electrode stimulation on for the positive reactions and off for the positive reactions. Here's aversive reactions to bitter or to sugar. You can see there's more aversive negative reactions, more bitter-like reactions when the stimulation is on than when it's off. That's the most dramatic change. The rats don't eat more because they like this food more. They eat more in spite of an enhanced disliking for the food, apparently, at the moment of the stimulation. That's a puzzle, a psychological puzzle, right? Which would need a psychological answer. And the dopamine mutant mice, this almost looks like they're going to have more positive liking reactions because these three bars are higher. This is sweet, sweeter, and sweetest. Again, sweet, sweeter, and sweetest. Three different sugar concentrations. The problem is that these are the control mice, the purple, and these are the mutant extra dopamine mice, the green. It's not that the green have greater liking. It's instead they have reduced liking. They either like only as much or less. So both of these are puzzles. And quite possibly at this point you're feeling very impatient with me throwing rat face kinds of experiments at you. We might well wonder, well, what would happen for a person? I mean, this just contrasts the wanting without liking. This is the notion that these mechanisms might be turning on wanting alone without the liking, but what would a person's experience be like in that situation? Well, you know, there are studies out there, and today we were talking this morning about one of the most famous cases of human electrode stimulation that came from the 50s and 60s, shortly after the Milner and Olds rat studies. Heath at Tulane University, Robert Heath, implanted patients with Olds and Milner type reward electrodes and had pleasure electrode people. And maybe his most famous case was B19, a 20-year-old young man who was implanted with the electrodes. A number of things going on in his life at the time. He had a button box that he could press to turn it on. He would press it up to 3,000 times in a single session, 3,000 times in a single session to stimulate it. So that could be really, really pleasant, one would think. up to 1,500 times in a single 3-hour session. And he would protest whenever you took the stimulator away at the end of the session, no, just a few more, just a few more. So what is the experience of this? Well, in Heath's words, it's producing, this is Heath describing B19, feelings of pleasure, it sounds like pleasure, alertness and warmth, goodwill. He had feelings of sexual arousal and described a compulsion to masturbate. So it could be pleasure, but is it really pleasure? You know, it's hard to tell. And Heath, in a book near the end of his life, raises the question, is it pleasure and why didn't we get really great exclamations? It is, one can note that he didn't report strong exclamations of pleasure. You know, there are things you can say at the moment when the nicest cake or sex you have, there are expressions, but this didn't sort of bubble out of B19. And the electrode, you know, never substituted for sex. Instead, it always made him want sex more. Heath even tried to harness this to channel his sexual directions, his sexual motivations. The electrode made him want sex more, just like the electrode made him want the electrode more. It's one case and it's hard to tell, but there are other cases too. So I'll just give one other example. Different decade, different team. A woman studied by Portnoy et al. In the 80s who had a deep thalamic electrode to control pain. The electrode did control pain. It could have also activated the mesolimbic systems. But she was brought back to the hospital. Here's the reason why. Not because it wasn't controlling pain, but because her family complains. At its most frequent, this patient self-stimulated throughout the day with her button box, neglecting personal hygiene and family commitments. You think this must be a marvelous button. It's so good that you would forego washing and dressing and family commitments in order to press continuously throughout the day. So what does she describe? Well, again, it's third person, but here's the account. Though sexual arousal was also prominent, no orgasm occurred, kind of like B19. She describes erotic sensations often intermixed with an undercurrent of anxiety. She also noted extreme thirst, drinking copiously during the session, and alternating generalized hot and cold sensations. There are pleasant bits in this description, maybe the erotic sensations. But if you just read the account, erotic sensations, undercurrent of anxiety, extreme thirst, alternating hot and cold, it isn't so pleasant. There are even some unpleasant bits. It isn't quite clear why a person would forego personal hygiene and family commitments in order to get this. Would you forego those things in order to get this experience if this is the description on sale? I don't want to say that pleasure electrodes have never really existed. There may be cases where there are, but I would say I've personally have looked a bit at the literature, and I would love it if people think there are better cases of real pleasure. I think that many of the pleasure, so-called pleasure electrode cases actually kind of fit this description, where the massive use of the electrode isn't quite explained by any account coming out of the patient. Now, it may be that it's because we don't have access to things that are happening within us. I certainly think that's true. But it's also, I think, the case that we're not, that the person isn't experiencing such a great conscious pleasure as to fully explain, in many cases, the motivation. So I just want to kind of say that there are human cases where wanting can soar above any experienced pleasures. And we need psychological explanations for that, and that may be relevant to addiction. The incentive sensitization hypothesis of Terry Robinson suggests that there really are many cases like this. It's not to say that all addicts have sensitized excessive wanting. That's not the theory. That's not the hypothesis. But there might be some who do. And if there are some who do, those could be cases who could have exactly this kind of cue-triggered wanting happening at moments without need of the other psychological explanations, right? Sensitization, it doesn't happen in everyone. Sensitization, when it happens, it's an increase in the reactivity of the mesolimbic system to the drugs that sensitize it and to cues for the drugs. Reactivity. It's not active all the time, even in someone who sensitizes. And not everyone sensitizes. Terry Robinson tells me that if we give high enough drugs, everyone will sensitize, all of his rats will sensitize, but at street level doses, not everyone sensitizes. Some individuals have a special susceptibility to sensitize. It's genetically linked. There's sex differences and sexual hormones can influence. Stress is an issue. There can be pre-exposures to stress can facilitate the sensitization. So there are things that determine if an individual is going to be sensitized or not. If an individual is going to be sensitized, what does it mean to be sensitized by these drugs? Well, this increase in reactivity far outlasts things like withdrawal. It can last almost permanently, possibly permanently, at least in rats. It can last a lifetime in rats. When it happens, what will happen is something like this. This is just one example from an early Terry Robinson experiment of dopamine release. What you're seeing here are dopamine release measured by microdialysis by the same dose of amphetamine in all these curves, the same dose of amphetamine. The only difference is that this amphetamine in the red line, the rats in the red line had previously been exposed to sort of binge doses of amphetamine weeks before, which can sensitize the system. Binge doses weeks before, but then weeks without any drugs. And now today, everybody gets the same amphetamine, and one group shows a lot more dopamine release than the other. The baseline isn't different, but the evoked, drug-evoked dopamine is more. That's an example of sensitization expressed as greater dopamine release. There are other changes, too, in the mesolimbic system, some of them anatomical and permanent. So this, from another Robinson lab study, showing differences in the anatomical spininess of rats, of neurons, in rats that were sensitized in the nucleus accumbens of neurons in the nucleus accumbens of rats that were previously sensitized. The neurons actually get more spiny, so it's an anatomical change that lasts and lasts and lasts and lasts in rats. What's it doing? You know, if these are synapses mediating the memory of the cues, it could be increasing the prediction value, but it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. If these are motivational synapses, if that's what these synapses are doing, then anything that increases them is going to increase that transformation of the cue into motivational value. Does it ever happen in people? I think up until about 3 years ago, the answer was there was zero evidence that it ever happened in people. And there were colleagues who would point that out to me again and again and again, and to Terry Robinson, that there was zero evidence that it happened in people. Today, there's some evidence that it happens in people. I mean, it could be that all the cocaine neuroimaging studies were evidence that it happens in people, but that would be, that's an unfair view. But here's a little bit, a marvelous study by Evans et al. A couple of years ago. What's marvelous about this is that it avoids many of the explanations of why drug addicts' brains light up to drug cues, because it's not a normal drug addict. This is a Parkinson's patient who's becoming addicted to the L-DOPA medication. So in normal drug addicts, the drug could be incredibly pleasant, there could be social reasons to take the drugs, everybody's doing it. In a Parkinson's patient who's taking more and more L-DOPA and then becoming addicted to that L-DOPA, it's only a few, dopamine dysregulation syndrome. But in those that happen, L-DOPA is not an incredibly pleasant drug. There's no social pressure, of course, to take it. It's sort of happening on its own as a bizarre phenomenon. But it can happen. And in this study, there's a correlation between the amount of dopamine release or reduced raclopride signal and the subjective ratings at this moment of L-DOPA exposure, at this moment of redosing, the subjective ratings of wanting to take more. Taking the drug kind of brings out the correlation of dopamine activation with wanting to take more. The greater the dopamine activation, the greater the wanting. There isn't really a correlation between dopamine activation and the liking for the drug. And it's happening especially in the patients. I mean, the dopamine activation, if that's a measure of sensitization in people, then the increased wanting is happening essentially only in the Parkinson's patients who are sensitized. Other Parkinson's patients who are not showing this change, if this is a sensitization change, and who don't have this compulsive addiction to their medication, they don't have it. So this, a dividing line here might be human sensitized people between. It's not a proof of principle, but it's an example that the principle is at least conceivable in people as well as in rats. Cue triggered ordinarily for incentive salience. These are the kinds of cues, of course, for addicts, but it's just building in, it's just tapping in, of course, to this cues that could activate in any of us the same mesolimbic systems. It may be a matter of degree. I think it is a difference of degree in the case of sensitization, but it's really the same kind of system. So that's a sort of explanation of an overlap. I've been boring you with sensitization and the cues, but I haven't said enough about why we can resist cues again and again and again, but then suddenly be unable to, right? What's the synergy? The synergy, conceivably an addiction, that would mimic the salt appetite synergy where suddenly a cue becomes more attractive today. This is the main point. It's a synergy. The degree of wanting triggered by a cue is a function of both the presence of that reward cue, but also the mesolimbic state at the moment, mesolimbic dopamine activation. And so that's going to mean that pulses of wanting, they'll come and go as cues come and go, yes, but they'll also come and go with mesolimbic activation, even if the cue is present. That's the point. Just one rat experiment to give an example of that. This is cue-triggered wanting. It's a study by Cindy Wavell in our lab, showing cue-triggered wanting in rats. The way it's working, it's going to be rats who are working for a sugary reward, though they're not getting it today. These rats have learned in the past that if they press a lever, they can earn a sugar pellet. They've learned that separately in the past. They've also separately in the past learned a Pavlovian association between a cue, a sound, beep, and a sugar pellet. This is the Pavlovian association. Beep, sugar pellet. It's just a cue. Right? The cue has never been paired with the act of working, so the cue has no habit of pressing the lever. The Pavlovian cue was learned separately from the instrumental learning. There's no habit. Today, we're going to, for the first time, present the cue while the rat is working for sugar. And we're also going to activate the dopamine system by giving little micro-injections of amphetamine in the nucleus accumbens, which will spill dopamine and turn on the system. And we're going to ask, what does the increase in dopamine do to the motivation for this reward? Let's imagine that if we're making the rat just feel nice, the rat could give up working because it feels nice all of a sudden if the dopamine substituted for reward. Let's imagine instead that the dopamine created a prediction, an enhanced prediction of reward, prediction of utility, expectation as the learning signal. We might expect that when we turn on the dopamine, the rat goes into the box, starts pressing, and keeps pressing throughout the half hour. It's a happy expectation. It has rose-colored glasses. It expects great reward. Let's imagine that instead the dopamine increased the pleasure of the taste. Well, let's not give any tastes then. Today in the test, it'll be extinction. There'll be no sugar. So if dopamine does enhance the pleasure of the taste, that won't play a role. Finally, let's imagine that this dopamine could interact synergistically with the cue. Multiplying cue-triggered wanting when the cue happens, but not doing much that's manifest in the absence of the cue. So here's the cue-triggered wanting, the basic phenomenon. The rat's working along for a half hour. The cue comes and goes. The cue's only 30 seconds. It's a sound that predicted sugar once. And when the cue starts, deet, the rat starts working more. When the sound goes away, it goes down. Deet, it works more. It starts to go way, way down because there's no sugar coming today. It's in extinction. But wherever it is at the moment the sugar cue comes, it starts to work more. That's cue-triggered wanting. But here's the dopamine effect. You're seeing a dose response curve of amphetamine dose, zero, more amphetamine in the nucleus accumbens. Here's the baseline of just pressing in the absence of a cue, normal pressing. You can see there's no increase. It's not putting rose-colored glasses on the rat. It's not making the rat predict, just work more, expecting the sugar will come and be nicer. If that were happening, the baseline pressing would go up. It's not doing that. Whoops, it's not doing it. It doesn't, when the CS minus comes, it doesn't do anything. But when the CS plus that predicts sugar comes, this goes higher. What's happening is that the mountain peaks are growing higher, the cue-triggered wanting is growing stronger, but the plateau on which the mountain peaks sit isn't changing at all. It's just magnifying the cue-triggered wanting, this dopamine activation. This is what sensitization does in a rat who has no amphetamine, in its brain today, but it was sensitized weeks before. It behaves as though it has amphetamine in its brain. The cues, mountains go higher, the baseline doesn't change. It's just magnifying the cue-triggered wanting. That's all it's doing, the sensitization. The sensitization was there all along, just like the amphetamine is there all along, but it only magnifies the cue-triggered wanting. Things that do this are things like amphetamine and other drugs, sensitization in that rat and conceivably in the addicts, natural appetites you saw with the salt appetite, very last experimental bit, just one slide, so that's very quick. Stress actually can key into this mechanism, I think, in a non-intuitive way. I want to emphasize the non-intuitive nature. We have good explanations for why stress makes people take more drugs. If stress makes them feel bad, turns on that nasty state, so we could take more drugs to get out of that nasty state. That's a good explanation. That's a sufficient explanation. And that can happen. I mean, we've all been in nasty states. We would all work to get out of it, maybe even take drugs to do that. But there is another way that stress can increase things like addictive wanting that doesn't require a nasty state. And this experiment is meant to show that. This is exactly the same thing you saw before, the Q-triggered one. But we're not doing necessarily an amphetamine injection. We could also do an amphetamine, just an injection, a micro-injection of CRF, that corticotropin-releasing factor stress signal in the same spot of the nucleus accumbens. Why do that? Well, everyone knows, as Pat told us today, nasty stress states turn on the CRF system. But also little tastes of reward turn on the CRF system. Go figure. Maybe it's doing something directly to the incentive mechanisms. CRF in the mesolimbic system can turn on dopamine release. Here's what happens if we turn on CRF directly by injecting it right there in the nucleus accumbens. Here's the same curve you saw before, only these are different rats. They're getting now either vehicle microinjections or CRF low or CRF high dose or amphetamine. And here's the crucial thing, these last two right columns. The high dose of CRF is here, the amphetamine is here. CRF in the nucleus accumbens does exactly the same thing as amphetamine in the nucleus accumbens. It's another way for stress to trick us. It can directly magnify this incentive impact. This means that even happy stresses, you've been promoted, you've had a paper, you've won the jackpot, even those which aren't making us feel terrible could conceivably trigger this kind of an increase in wanting. So it's something to think about. Oops. So that's really, I think, the end of the experiments. These mesolimbic mechanisms, to give a metaphor, I won't give any more detail, many more experimental evidence, but a way to think about it, these mesolimbic mechanisms, in a sense, we kind of think of them as turning up the light bulb of the incentive salience illumination, lighting up the drugs, the sugar cues, the sex cues, the other things, almost indiscriminately. But what focuses, what makes it sex versus drugs, versus binge eating, versus something else, that we don't have at all a decent handle on. Although there's some reasons to think that if the mesolimbic dopamine system floats all boats of incentives, things like amygdala-related circuits may help to kind of focus the incentive salience on one thing at a time, kind of like the projector lens that's focusing the light bulb on one thing at a time, so that one thing becomes wanted. If we turn on that, we can make one thing become most wanted in a winner-take-all fashion so that a rat, at least, goes to just one and not the other. I won't go into that. So the point of all of this, to sum up, has been motivation is not reducible to previously just, it's not just the learned values. It's not just the cue. It's the cue times the state of this brain at the moment. Sensitization could, which changes the synapses in our brain, might change our learned recollections or habits, but they might interact with this synergy. If this synergy is important, it could be one of the reasons why we can successfully resist cues at many states, but when stress comes along, or when we take a drink, or when something else, for reasons of its own, activates the reactivity of these mesolimbic systems, then the cue exerts the thing. So I've probably run out of time. I had 4 slides left to do issues applications. I don't know, should I? Okay, so I'll just kind of, I can do this in 2 minutes. There are great objections to everything I've said. So one objection would be, what I've said, it really can't be a mechanism of compulsive wanting because wanting can't be compulsive. One version of this great objection is been raised by Lynn Stevens and George Graham. They point out that, you know, compulsion comes from the outside. It's like the strong wind that carries us against our will. But incentive salience is coming from within. Motivations always come from within. So in a sense, sensitized wanting is us. It's not the outside compelling us. It is us. That's a good point. And I think Steve Pearson and Hannah Pickard will be talking about ways in which addiction might not want to be thought, we might not want to think about it as a compulsion. But a little incentive salience thing to think about. Maybe, I think, incentive salience can sometimes act as though it were a wind outside ourselves, because we identify as selves with our cognitive desires. If we were to have a cognitive desire pointing in one direction, but an incentive salience cue-triggered want pointing in a different, then we would identify with the cognitive desire, and an aspect of the cue-triggered want could feel as from without ourselves, conceivably. A different kind of objection would be, could a want ever be strong enough to compel? You know, aside from being within or without, can it be strong enough? Well, that's an open question. That's an empirical question. Wanting comes in degrees. Could it, at its strongest, sensitization makes it very strong. Sensitization combined with drugs on board makes it stronger still. Maybe most of us have never experienced a peak of cue-triggered wanting of that intensity. You know, maybe some of us have. If it happens, it isn't that it necessarily has to compel every time, but if we were all called upon to resist it 100 times in a row at that level of intensity, I think there's a certain probabilistic nature to this, and perhaps none of us could resist it all 100 times in a row. That, I think that's plausible. Incentive salience, just to sort of relate it to George's theme today, I can simply say I think it's entirely compatible with George. Perhaps he would agree. It's not the same. Discounting involves more than incentive salience, so incentive salience is not an explanation of discounting. But maybe in some moments, wanting can contribute to collapses of the time frame. It's a reason why we would focus on this cue and its reward at the moment. There are differences between incentive salience and temporal discounting. Discounting is a cognitive operation. Incentive salience doesn't have to be. Also, as George described to us, for discounting, it's the temporal closeness of the reward that matters. For incentive salience, what's really crucial is the temporal proximity of the cue for reward. And cues that are closest to the reward are most potent. Just as an example, if a person is an alcoholic and they can resist the sight of the bar door, and they can open the door and resist the sight of the bar, and they can walk up to the bar and they can resist the sight of the glass, and then you can pour it into the glass and clink the ice cubes and then smell that drink. If these are not all equal in temptation, if this last is most potent, well, that fits with the incentive salience evidence from rats. The most proximal cue is the most potent elicitor. Third of the fourth, there may be ways to deal with it. I think Richard Holton, as he describes the resolution, as he describes his important thoughts on resolution as a way, having a prior plan may be helpful. That's the Odysseus notion. This is a question I'd love to have opinions on, and maybe Richard will address it. When an incentive salience want happens, does it change our mind? Do we become a new self at the moment? Or does it necessarily do that? Or could it dissociate from ourselves so that we would experience it really as an alien, irrational want, something that we couldn't quite explain, quite identify with, but is still acting? I hope that the second one might be possible, but that's a strained notion. And very, very last, relating this to willpower, of course, as Steve and others have pointed out, addicts have not only this issue of bottom-up processes, but also there's loss of top-down control, maybe from prefrontal dysfunction in some addicts, but all of us, as I think we'll hear about later in the conference, can experience a temporary exhaustion of top-down control at certain moments, so all of us. Both happen. When a loss of top-down control happens together with high incentive salience peaks, well, that could be especially dangerous. And very, very last, does anything I've said have any implications at all for free will? I have no idea. I hope it doesn't. I believe in mechanisms. I would like to sort of think of myself as in a certain sense of free will, though I do not know what that means, and I'll turn to you. Does it have any implications that you hadn't already thought about as philosophers dealing with other notions of temptation? I don't think so. Incentive salience is a mechanism of temptation. It's a mechanism of temptation. But whatever temptations were to begin with, they haven't been changed by this notion of incentive salience. They're just an intensity mechanism. I'm sorry if I've gone too long. Thank you for your patience.